From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
Free love is the going thing, so I took off my wedding ring and embarked on my final fling of losing you. Borrowed love is awful cheap. He was fun, but I can't sweep. I toss and turn and then I weep. I'm losing you.
Country music singer, songwriter, and legend June Carter Cash died last night in Nashville. She was 73. Daughter of the famous singing Carter family, wife of the towering, difficult Johnny Cash, who survives her. June Carter Cash was a musical bridge between old school Appalachia and the Nashville evolution. Tonight, we look back on the music and long journey home of June Carter Cash.
If I could catch you in a little line, some way just by losing you.
But first, we begin with the latest turn in country music to patriotism. Novelist and opera buff Ann Patchett, author of the best-selling Bel Canto, has turned her ear lately to country, and what she finds is all red, white, and blue. She joins me from Nashville, Tennessee. Ann Patchett, thanks for being with us.
I'm glad to be here.
It's wonderful to have you. And country music is no stranger to patriotism, but even so, you're hearing something different right now.
Well, it's true. It seems that they keep drumming out anthems almost for every battle in country music. It's become very moralistic and very political. Not like June.
Not like June, and not like the origins. What are you contrasting this with? Is there something new here, Anne? Is some tradition of country music being driven out by patriotism in your mind?
I don't think it's new, actually. I think it goes back to Merle Haggard, who really drew this line in the sand against the hippie liberal protester, which I don't actually even think is so much Merle Haggard's stance, but Merle Haggard's persona for his job. That was the song that he sang.
And it worked in 1967.
It worked, and it really sort of set the tone for country music. You know, you've got Merle Haggard, who's a really wild guy, much more of the Johnny Cash school. And yet he really got us going on a sort of a patriotism that said it was very wrong to question government.
So much so that you say, Anne, you write, that at this point country music is not about geography but about ideology. How would you describe that ideology?
Well, I think it's the ideology of the red states. I mean, I think that it stretches all across America, and it's a sort of conservative politicism that isn't represented in any other art form. That's what's so interesting about country music is, you know, if you are conservative, you're probably not going to find yourself in the movies, in pop music, in classical music, but you can find yourself in country music. You're not going to find yourself in modern dance, you know?
I guess not, but there was a time, and you write about it, when country music, you say, lighted beneath its listeners, the fire it lit was to get down to the bar, get drunk, and see if you couldn't find somebody to go home with.
Well, I was just listening to the June Carter Cash song.
Yeah,
such a great song.
Right.
I took off my wedding ring to go and have a final fling.
Freedom's the new thing.
That's what country music used to incite us towards, instead of the very middle of the road.
But is that not still out there? I mean, the hard side of the tracks, the down and out, the long hangover?
It may be out there in the bars in Nashville. It is actually out there in the bars in Nashville, but it's not on the radio station. I have no idea. Are you a Clear Channel station?
No, we're not. We're public radio.
Okay, well then.
So let her rip. What are you suggesting?
I'm suggesting that the folks at Clear Channel Radio.
This is the huge conglomerate that owns I don't know how many thousand plus stations across the country now.
It's the Barnes & Noble, the Walmart, the McDonald's, the USA Today, the Fox News.
With what impact, with what imprint, Anne?
Pardon me?
With what imprint on the country music that's heard? With what impact?
Well, it's that they make one decision. All of these radio stations have one playlist. So if you're tuning in at 910 in Oklahoma or at 910 in Los Angeles or at 910 in Brooklyn, you're going to be hearing the exact same country music song.
But is drinking and loving taboo?
No, it is. It really is. The songs tend to be much more geared towards self-help, self-actualization. Not that I think that's terrible, but, you know, it's not what we were expecting to find in country music. But nobody is nobody's having a lot of sex and getting drunk anymore in country music, and I find that a disappointment.
You write about how Tracy Lawrence has a recent song that talks about his grandfather teaching him how to cuss and how to pray, and that was banned from several radio stations?
That's right, and look, you've just said the word cuss on the radio. and you have to put that up against Merle Haggard's song in the late 60s where he's talking about getting really drunk and he cures it with a hot afternooner. And let me tell you, nobody's saying afternooner on the radio anymore.
Maybe not. So we had Merle Haggard in 67, Lee Greenwood, of course, with his famous 83 God Bless the USA. We've heard a lot of that lately. What are the new patriotic chart toppers in country music, Ann Patchett?
We have Toby Keith and we have Daryl Worley, and they're talking about things like we're fighting for our freedom and our land. And it's insane. We're not fighting for our freedom or our land, as a matter of fact. But suddenly, if you hear it as an anthem on the radio station and you're humming, you're thinking, why are we going to war? Oh, yeah, we're fighting for our freedom and our land, because that's what I'm singing along with the radio. It's pretty reductive understanding of why we're going to war.
You've got Toby Keith singing, and the Statue of Liberty started shaking her fist, and the eagle will fly, and there's going to be hell when you hear Mother Freedom, and so on. As you write, we get the point.
Yeah, it's not a subtle business, no.
And Patchett, where does this leave us? A kind of a watered-down country in your mind, or?
Yes, it's a very, very watered-down. Do you remember that boy band called Menudo?
Yes.
This is country music is sort of going the way of Menudo, in that I think it's a room full of producers who are trying to figure out what they can come up with, who's going to play on Clear Channel Radio. Because truly, in Nashville, you cannot believe how much talent is here. There are so many wonderful singer and songwriters here, and they're not getting on the radio because they're doing things. Actually, a lot of them are really going back to music that's more traditional.
And, of course, we lived a long time on the legacies of artists who got their start before radio was so monopolized, June Carter Cash among them.
Absolutely, and what a hero she was. And there are a lot of people. I think of Iris DeMent, who's so incredibly talented, Gillian Welch, and they're really doing music that comes out of the Carter family tradition, but they're not getting played on the radio because they're thought of as too old-fashioned.
Ann Patchett, thanks so much for joining us tonight from Nashville.
Thank you, and thank you for paying attention to June Carter Cash. We're really going to miss her.
It's our pleasure. Ann Patchett is author of the novel Bel Canto. Her essay, The Country of Country, recently appeared in the New York Times Magazine.
American girls and American guys, we'll always stand up and salute. We'll always recognize when we see old glory flying. There's a lot of men dead, so we can sleep in peace at night when we lay down our heads. My daddy served in the army. We lost his right eye, but he flew a flag out in our yard.
I was standing by my window on one cold and cloudy day.
Country music legend June Carter Cash died last night. She was 73. Born Valerie June Carter in Mesa Spring, Virginia, June Carter Cash grew up with old-school country in the Carter family, the clan that many have called the first family of country music. As a young teenager, she was heard across the nation on radio with her mother Mabel and her sisters. As a young adult, she performed at the Grand Ole Opry. She sang with Elvis and navigated a 35-year marriage and musical collaboration with country music icon Johnny Cash. June Carter Cash sang and played a lifetime of country music from old style to new. Tonight, we listen back to her music and the stories of a remarkable life. Were you a fan of June Carter Cash? With her passing, will the circle be unbroken, or is old-school country music and American culture disappearing? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Helping us remember June Carter Cash tonight, we're joined from Nashville, Tennessee, by Bill Friscus Warren, a writer for several country music publications and author of Heartaches by the Number, country music's 500 greatest singles. Good evening and welcome, Bill Friscus Warren.
Good evening.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's good. Thank you.
And from Weston, Connecticut, we're joined by Mark Zwanzer, a documentary filmmaker and author of Will You Miss Me When I'm Gone? The Carter Family and Their Legacy in American Music. Welcome, Mark Zwanzer.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Thanks so much for coming on. So, Bill Friscus-Warren, take us in. June Carter Cash, what did she stand for in American country music?
Well, June Carter's legacy is twofold. There was her lifelong role in keeping the Carter family circle and later the Carter Cash family circle together, unbroken. And that, you know, that wasn't easy with her husband's hell-raising tendencies in the 50s and 60s. But just as significant, I think, were June's gifts as a performer, and they're often overlooked, particularly her improvisational gifts. She was a star, as you said, before her husband was, touring with Hank Williams and Elvis Presley in the 50s.
Yep.
And when she was on the Opry with Minnie Pearl, the queen of country comedy, Minnie Pearl said that she thought June had the best comedic timing she'd ever seen. And if you look at the old clips, it's really hard to argue with her.
Give us a sense of that comedy, that persona that she had on stage in the 50s in the Grand Ole Opry.
Well, she had a lot of different characters that she would play. One of them was Aunt Polly. And then there were just her gags, her skits. The earliest bit that she did was with her uncle A.P. Carter and her aunt Sarah and her mother Maybelle on Border Radio in the late 30s and early 40s. She would carry around this plank, this board around the stage, and sort of be a nuisance and prevent them from getting a number underway. And finally, A.P. would say, "What are you doing, girl?" And she'd respond, "Well, I've got my room. I've got my board. I just need a room." As you see, I don't have the comedic timing she does. But
you, Bill Friscus-Warren, are no June Carter Cash.
Right.
But you've got the story, and we appreciate it.
There you go.
Mark Zwanzer, help us understand the place of the Carter family. It's getting to be a long time ago now, and I'm sure we have a lot of listeners who missed that 100%. What was their role in bringing country music into the popular mainstream through radio, ultimately, I guess?
Well, it really began on record. In 1927, they made their first recordings, and along with Jimmy Rogers, they recorded it at the now famous Bristol Sessions in Bristol, Tennessee in 1927, 76 years ago this summer. And they really proved that this music that came off the porch out of Appalachia had a big audience. And and when they got on board a radio in the late 30s, 1938, they started on board a radio, they were heard in every state in the nation and 13 other countries to boot, at the top of Canada and the bottom of Mexico. They were on the radio twice a day, in the warp and weave of life, and in the long shut-in winters, rural folks could tune in their radio and tune into the Carter family.
So they were huge. And what were some of the songs, name them for us, that would have been giant hits in those days?
Well, I mean, you know, the favorites, of course, would be songs like Wildwood Flower. Will the Circle Be Unbroken was popularized a little bit later. I'm singing Tonight in My Blue Eyes.
Great song.
Is a wonderful song. And, I mean, they had, literally recorded hundreds and hundreds of songs.
Keep on the Sunny Side of Life, is that from that period?
That was from that. They recorded that very early, but that was the theme song. They came in on the radio every show with Keep on the Sunny Side, and they signed off with Keep on the Sunny Side.
And was this seen in those years as hick music, country music, or was it listened to all over the country? Was it rural or urban, both? Where did it have its greatest base of fans?
You know, it was called hillbilly music, and, you know, its base of fans were really rural country folks. But at the same time, you know, this radio could wriggle into any place, and, you know, there were urbanites who listened to it. There are people in the coal camps who listened to it. You know, you couldn't keep that music out of your living room.
Stand by. Mark Zwanzer, Bill Friscus-Warren. We're talking tonight about country singer, songwriter, and legend June Carter Cash, daughter of the old-school Carter family, soulmate and collaborator of Johnny Cash, icon in her own right. Died yesterday in Nashville at age 73. You're listening to Engine 143 behind me, performed by a young June Carter with the Carter family in 1939. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
The firebox door, the flames were rolling high. I'm glad I'm going to be an engineer on the piano roll to die. The dark
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about country singer, songwriter, and legend June Carter Cash, daughter of the old-school Carter family, soulmate and collaborator of Johnny Cash, icon in her own right, and died yesterday in Nashville at age 73. Here's June Carter Cash, 20 years old, 1949, with the popular duo of that time, Homer and Jethro, singing Baby, It's Cold Outside. Listen for the comedy here.
Get home, Flatters. I can't stay here all night.
It's kind of cold out there, Jill. Yep, it sure is.
I ain't a fixin' to stay.
But, baby, it's cold outside.
I gotta get away.
But, baby, it's cold outside.
This evening has been
hoping that you fall
very
in.
Nice.
I'll hold your hands, are just like feet.
I will start to
worry. Watch your hurry.
And you'll get the shotgun
if
down.
If he does, we'll have to leave town.
Really, I'd better
have
hurry.
A drink, watch your
Maybe
hurry.
Maybe just a half a jug
Put
more.
Some Eddie Arnold records on while
There
I
she
go.
Is, June Carter Cash, or June Carter at that point in 1949 with Baby, It's Cold Outside. It may not be your favorite version. It may not be the high point of his her career, but it was quite a career, both musically and in love through her marriage to Johnny Cash, a tough man to be married to. I'm joined tonight by Bill Friscus Warren, joining us from Nashville, Tennessee. He's a writer and regular contributor for Country Music Magazine and music editor for the Nashville Scene. And from Weston, Connecticut, by Mark Zwanitzer, documentary filmmaker and author of Will You Miss Me When I'm Gone? The Carter Family and Their Legacy in American Music. Were you a fan of June Carter Cash? And what about it? Will the circle be unbroken, or is old school country disappearing from American culture? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can join us tonight. Bill Friscus Warren, now to my ear, that's not what I turned to. Was that wildly popular in 1949?
Yeah, it sure was, and not just among country audiences where it was a top 10 country hit, but it nearly cracked the pop top 20. So a lot of people across the United States were listening to it at the time.
That's some wound-up, tight and cute comedy there. The underlying song's been sung many times since, and a wonderful song, but a lot of kitsch around it there, Mark Zwanitzer.
June, as you said, had great comedic timing. And they brought her in specifically for the comedy for that song. You know, I mean, that was a point in time where June would be on the at the Opry at that point, and she might be talking about how she'd gone over to visit some soldiers recently and how she got down in one of those wolf holes, and they'd say, "No, June, you mean a foxhole." She said, "Well, a fox might have dug it, but there's wolves in there by the time I got there."
Now that is country humor. That doesn't come off Brooklyn, I guess.
No.
Bill Friscus Warren, describe the path for us from the sound we just heard there through the 50s. I mean, we're going to end up with some really challenging music, Ring of Fire, for example. But in the 50s, June Carter was managed by Colonel Tom Parker, the man who managed Elvis Presley. She actually sang with Elvis. Take us through that decade, through that time, Elvis, and how she ended up coming into the circle of Johnny Cash.
Well, as I said before, she toured with Elvis and opened for Hank Williams when she was touring with her mother and her sisters Helen and Anita, mm-hmm. and she really was a star, but you know, before Johnny Cash was. On the Opry, she could, you know, keep the crowd in stitches for an extended period of time, and often did so when people were delayed getting to the stage on time, either because they ran out of gas or somewhere off in the tavern, what have you.
Was she an Opry headliner? Was she the Opry headliner?
She was a star on the Prince Albert segment of the Opry in the 50s, and that was a signature segment for the show. That was a coveted slot.
And are we still talking radio there? When does TV begin to come in, and was she part of that?
She definitely was part of television. That, of course, wasn't until much later when her husband had his network TV series.
But not in the Opry days.
Yeah. I'm not sure when the Opry started being televised. I want to say maybe in the early 60s. Mark, do you know?
June was not really a part of the Opry television so much.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
And then the Johnny Cash connection. How does it happen?
Well, June was touring as an opening act for Johnny. She was touring with her mother Maybelle and her two sisters, and And then she ended up opening as a solo act for Johnny, doing stand-up and doing some singing. And while touring with him, started to fall in love with him and was scared scared to death of it because he was such a hellraiser. And that's how we come to Ring of Fire, where she expresses that mix of fear and that desire that she felt.
Let's hear it.
Yeah.
Let's Ring of Fire.
Love is a burning thing, and it makes a fiery ring, bound by wild desire. I fell into a ring of fire. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire.
1963, Johnny Cash singing the song, co-written by his wife, June Carter Cash, Ring of Fire. Mark Zwanisser, you know, we've got the brassy trumpets here and the kind of soothing background harmony, but if you take that away, this is one rough, rough song. It seems to me a kind of marriage of pop music at some level, but also there's a real Old Testament fire and brimstone in here. Is this out of Carter's old school country roots? Is this out of old school church?
And it was out of old school life, you know. I mean, there was real guilt in this relationship. You know, Johnny was not free from his first wife, and when they first met, June was actually married as well. You know, so yeah, there's old church and old guilt, and there's a big part of that in that song.
The lyrics are so austere. I guess this was written before they were actually married and performed later, but I mean, love is a burning thing and it makes a fiery ring, bound by wild desire. I fell into a ring of fire. Bill Friscus Warren, among country lyrics, to my ear, these really stand out. They're so stark.
Well, they are, and they're very suggestive. I mean, you know, you have June as the co-writer who makes them seem like, you know, the lyrics are expression of fear, and then you have Johnny just taking the song over and owning it and sounding like he can't wait to just leap into the flames.
Let's go. Exactly. But you hear the woman in the lyrics, if you listen through, the taste of love is sweet when hearts like ours meet. I fell for you like a child. Oh, but the fire went wild. Was this an immediate hit, Bill Friscus Warren, or did it take some getting used to?
Well, actually, it was first recorded by June's sister, Anita, who recorded it under the title Love's Burning Ring of Fire in 1962. June was concerned about even sharing it with Johnny, you know, for fear that he might know what he already knew, and that is that she was in love with him. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Anita's version didn't have the passion behind it or the story behind it, and so it sunk. And then when Johnny got a hold of it, it was number one for 7 weeks, and I think it, too, was like a top 20 pop hit.
Mark Zwanisser, describe this romance. It went on for a long time. It was very difficult. June Carter Cash wrote about Johnny Cash. There's a lot of power to him. When John walks on that stage, the rest of them might as well leave. How did they draw closer and ultimately marry?
Well, first of all, let me say that it took a very brave woman, June Carter Cash, to face down Johnny Cash has very serious drug problems.
Talk about just 60s. How serious that was.
Well, I mean, he was a mess. He would show up at June's parents' house, Eck and Maybell, in a sort of an amphetamine craze, absolutely wild, bug-eyed, and they would feed him and put him to bed and all be worried that, you know, Johnny didn't have family to take care of him. June's father Eck used to say, "God's got a plan for Johnny Cash." You know, that family really, really, really brought him through very difficult times, and it was a fearful time. And You know, June is a brave, was a brave soul. I mean, a 10-year-old, she was a national star.
Mm-hmm.
At, you know, in 1955, she went off to New York to be, go to acting school on her own. She was raising a daughter on her own. You know, she used to go, she used to ride motorcycles with her dad and go with barnstorming planes, you know, for joy rides. I mean,
so this was no shrinking violet, and still Johnny Cash was a handful.
Well, I mean, it took her and her whole family to stand up to him and you know, hide the pills and bring him through that very difficult time. And you know, it wasn't always easy for the next 35 years, but she settled him, and they had a great and special professional and personal relationship.
Johnny Cash wrote in his autobiography, "What June did for me was post signs along the way, lift me when I was weak, encourage me when I was discouraged, and love me when I was alone and felt unlovable. She was the greatest woman I've ever known." Neil's calling from Lynn, Massachusetts. Hi, Neil. You're on the air.
Hi. It's really great to listen to this show tonight. I'm sorry about the passing of June Carter.
As are we all.
And I'm praying for Johnny, because he's not in that good a health himself.
Diabetes, I think Johnny Cash has right now.
Yeah, and he's probably sad. But I want to bring to your guest's attention a dual tape I picked up called Johnny Cash at Folsom Prison and San Quentin.
Mm-hmm.
And in one of the songs, a very popular song that a lot of country western people have sung or covered, is a song called Jackson.
Famous
Are any
song.
Of your guests familiar with that version that they sang on live at San Quentin?
Yeah. Let me ask them, Neil. Neil, what does that song say to you?
Okay, what it says to me, that this is one of the most powerful, energetic, up-tempo versions of Jackson I've ever heard by a male and female duo.
Got it, Neil. Thanks for your call. Let's listen. Jackson won a Grammy in 1967. Johnny Cash and June Carter Cash.
I'm going to Jackson. Gonna mess around. Yeah, I'm going to Jackson. Look out, Jackson Town.
Wow, and there June Carter Cash just ripping, standing right up to Johnny Cash singing Jackson. Now, this is live, obviously. We can hear the background, but Bill Friscus Warren, maybe you know, is this the San Quentin live version that we're hearing here?
I think it is, yes.
How did they end up in that prison? Remind us of the story.
Well, frankly, I don't recall, Mark. Do you know?
Well, you know, it was Johnny used to do a lot of prisons, play a lot of prisons. He had a big following in prison.
And was it really, was this Johnny, I don't know, mentoring, tending to the imprisoned, or was this marketing for the man in black?
No, I think he, you know, I think he was, you know, he grew up hard luck. Johnny grew up, you know, on a government handout land, you know, and he always felt a part of the underdog. And, you know, I think it was much beyond image. I think that was a part of him.
And you can hear Bill Friscus Warren. You can hear June really, really letting it rip here. This is full-bodied woman.
Well, I think it's great that you're playing this, because it kind of represents an enduring kind of dialectic in country music between, you know, here's this woman of faith, a clear Christian woman, devout, but she also can revel in her own sexuality and both come together, you know, in her career and in her life, and she can do that with integrity. I think a lot of people found that refreshing and inspiring.
I sure do. Let's hear some more. San Quentin votes for June Carter Cash and Johnny Cash right there. It won a Grammy in 1967 with Jackson. Bill, how about June Carter Cash's career after she married Johnny? She'd already had a big career on many fronts. How much did she sustain? How much did she put away to take care of him and their family?
Well, she really didn't. She really kind of moved out of the spotlight in the early 70s. Of course, she was in the spotlight on their network TV show, but that was Johnny's show, and she had a big role, of course. But they had their son, John Carter Cash, in 1970, I believe. And and although they took him out on the road at first, and she actually helped tell stories or told stories of nursing him in the wings in between numbers and such, she really did focus on kind of keeping the family together in the last 30 years of her life. She did release a solo record in 1975, her first solo album, but then didn't release another one until 1999 when she released the Grammy-winning Press On, which was something of a musical autobiography and a very moving record.
Was that a willing stand-down, Mark Zwanitzer? What was her attitude, June Carter Cash, after marrying Johnny Cash in 1968? Was she just as happy to step out of the spotlight or not?
Well, you know, she was always on the road with John, and I don't think it's hard to say she was ever really truly out of the spotlight. I mean, she might have been well shadowed by the big guy, but she was still on stage, and she loved being a performer, and she wanted to be a performer all her life, and she was never shy about it, and she never complained about it. You know, you hear people, you know, complain about fame and celebrity. You know, she never complained a bit. She would, you know, she would be happy to be at home. She'd be happy to be on the road. And it was wonderful. You know, she put that CD out a few years back, Press On, and in the last year or so, she was back in the studio with her daughter, Carlene, and her niece, Lori, and she was working on some more music of her own.
Just kept it going. We're talking tonight about country singer, songwriter, and legend June Carter Cash, daughter of the old-school Carter family, soulmate and collaborator of Johnny Cash, icon in her own right, died yesterday in Nashville at age 73. Behind us here, If I Had a Hammer, a duet with Johnny Cash in 1972. You can join the conversation. Were you a fan of June Carter Cash, and what about it? Will the circle be unbroken, or is old-school country disappearing? Have you felt the ring of fire? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We'll be right back.
Brothers and the sisters all over this land. I'd sing out danger.
If I had a hammer.
I'd sing out warning.
If I had a
hammer. I'd sing out danger.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about country singer, songwriter, and legend June Carter Cash, died yesterday in Nashville at age 73. Here she is from 1999, her album Press On. And this song, I Used to Be Somebody, reflecting on the passing of friends and the fickle nature of fame.
Well, the place was New York City, and the hour was growing late. We had walked from the streets of Harlem to the Greenwich Village gate. We were young and foolish and trying out for fame. He said James Dean was his name. And I held the rose that he gave me for an hour. He wrote down the words while I picked the wild flower. Cause I used to be somebody, Lord, I used to have a friend. I'd like to be somebody again. I used to be somebody.
June Carter Cash on a 1999 CD, I Used to Be Somebody. We're talking about the singer, songwriter, legend who died yesterday in Nashville at age 73. My guest tonight, Bill Friscus Warren, joining us from Nashville, and from Weston, Connecticut, Mark Zwanitzer. You can join the conversation too. Were you a fan of June Carter Cash? What did old school country music bring to American culture? And did you grow up with this music? Did you not? Does it speak to you today? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Eliza's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Eliza. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Great to have you.
I just wanted to thank you for the show, first of all. I'm 26 years old.
26.
And,
great.
Yeah, pretty young. And I just wanted to say really quickly that I love old country. I listen to all the old stuff, the Carters, Jimmy Rogers, Gene Autry, Hank Williams. And
Eliza, how did that music get its hooks into you? Was it in your parents' record cabinet, or what happened?
Actually, through a combination of two different things. I listened to a lot of old folk, Dylan, from my parents. And then I also, when I was younger, when I was in my teens and early 20s and still, got really into punk music, and which had cultivated kind of a really interesting reference to country music in the early 90s, where bands started covering old country songs and Johnny Cash songs. And I found that tie made a lot of sense to me.
So, Eliza, you're 26. When you listen to this, where does it take you? Is it old timey? Is it geographic? Is it a state of mind? What is it that you take from it?
I don't know what it is. I feel like a lot of where I first came to the old country was almost in the rebelliousness of it. When I first started listening to Johnny Cash, that was my first link into older country music. And I guess it echoed a lot of what I heard in the punk music I listened to. It was the same feel to me, even though it was a different sound.
That's wild. Eliza, it's great to have your call. Thanks so much for calling in. Steve's calling from Dedham, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve. You're on the air. Hello, Steve. Are you there?
Excuse me?
Hi. You're on the air, Steve.
Yes. I want to pay tribute to June Carter Cash. As opposed to your previous caller, I'm 56.
Okay.
I started listening. I grew up in Massachusetts. Was into Johnny Cash for probably when I was about 13 or 14, along with Elvis and Roy Orbison. But it took June. When June came along, I really had no appreciation before that and no much awareness of the whole Appalachian music.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that it created, she created a whole new dimension in his music and them together. I saw them. I went to college in California. I saw them in a show in Oakland in probably about 66, 67. So that was, you know, just before the romance was developing there, just before they got
just
married.
Just before they got married, that's right.
Yeah.
Wow, what a great memory.
Yeah.
Steve, thanks. Our time's running down, but I'm sorry, but I want to thank you for your call. I want to raise something, though, with my guest that you just brought up. In these two singers, these two artists, Johnny Cash and June Carter Cash, Bill Friscus Warren, we had two personalities meeting here, two big personalities, but were there also two musical strains? I mean, I hear something different in Johnny Cash, what he brings to the table, and what June Carter Cash brings to the table.
Yeah, you know, as the last caller or the caller before that said, you know, June really brought a mountain sound to the table, and Johnny's sound is a bit more aggressive, a bit more steeped in Southern blues and R&B influences, even if they're more implicit.
Mm-hmm.
So there is kind of a coming together there of kind of different types of country music, but with different sensibilities.
Mark Zwanitzer, give us just the facts of the family here, because it can be confusing. June was married twice before Johnny to Carl Smith and Edwin Rip Nix.
Right.
She and Johnny had John Carter Cash, one son, in 1970.
Correct.
She's mother from an earlier marriage of Carlene Carter, is that right?
Carlene Carter is her daughter by Carl Smith. And Roseanne or Rosie is her daughter by Rip Nix.
And then Roseanne Cash.
Yeah, Roseanne has three sisters, so Johnny had four daughters with his first wife.
And Roseanne Cash is from Johnny Cash's first marriage.
First marriage, correct.
And Johnny Cash, I read now, is himself seriously ill. Diabetes, pneumonia? As I understand that,
he's not really been well for a number of years, and June spent a lot of time and energy looking
looking out for him. And so he's had many different diagnoses, and he's not particularly well.
They have homes in Clinch Mountains in Virginia, in Jamaica, and in Nashville. Mm-hmm. Bill Friscus Warren, do you know where Johnny Cash makes his home now?
The main Cash place is in Hendersonville, which is just north of Nashville, about a half an hour's drive. They have a sprawling three-story home that looks out over Old Hickory Lake. It's quite lovely.
Well, it's quite a tribute in the music and in the words of the man himself. Johnny Cash said, "She knew me, knew the kernel of me, deep inside me." I want to thank both of you for being with us tonight. It's been great to listen back to this music and great to have your insights. Mark Zwanitzer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Mark Zwanitzer is a documentary filmmaker and author of Will You Miss Me When I'm Gone? The Carter Family and Their Legacy in American Music. And Bill Friscus Warren in Nashville, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Tom. It was nice to be here.
Bill Friscus Warren is writer and regular contributor for Country Music Magazine. He's author of Heartaches by the Number, Country Music's 500 Greatest Singles. We're going to close the show with June Carter Cash and Johnny Cash singing The Far Side Banks of Jordan. You can continue the conversation on our website. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. This is On Point.
I will rise up with a shout and come running through the shallow water, reaching for your hand. Through this life we labor hard to earn our meager fare. It's brought us trembling hands and failing eyes.
In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
These despicable acts were committed by killers whose only faith is hate. And the United States will find the killers, and they will learn the meaning of American justice.
From the beginning of the war in Afghanistan, which was in early October of 2001, until about February or March of 2002, we were making good progress in dismantling the basic structure of al-Qaeda. Then we started to redirect our attention to Iraq, and al-Qaeda has regenerated.
We have thousands of police in Baghdad who have now come back to work and who are being put to work on the streets of Baghdad. We have opened jails so that people who are detained can indeed be put in jail. We have started aggressive patrols at night. Last night, we ran over 300 patrols in Baghdad and arrested 92 criminals.
My understanding is that there might be as many as 10,000 to 14,000 remains that exist here, based on what the medical officials, the Iraqi medical officials, who have began to exhume bodies.
The Palestinian's top peace negotiator handed in his resignation. Mr. Arakat himself refused to comment. No reasons were given for the resignation, but he was not scheduled to participate in Saturday night's talks, and some officials here feel that perhaps he felt sidelined.
There's a light of hope in Texas. There's 51 heroes who have stood up. For so many Texas legislators to agree and walk out demonstrates the depth of their commitment, the strength of their purpose, and the nobility of their cause.
The legal structure for a re-election campaign was put in place as a result of the filing of what's called FEC Form 1 and FEC Form 2. These are the legal forms necessary so that the structure around which a campaign will eventually be built can begin to take place.
And there's a week. President Bush promises to hunt down those responsible for Monday's bombing in Riyadh that killed 34. Presidential candidate Bob Graham says the Bush administration has dropped the ball in the war on terror. The new American administrator of Iraq, Paul Bremer, says steps are being taken to stop rampant crime in Baghdad. A mass grave containing over 3,000 human remains is discovered south of Baghdad. Saab Erekat, the Palestinian's minister in charge of negotiations with Israel, resigns. Texas Congressman Chiro Rodriguez praises the 50-plus Democratic state legislators who fled to Oklahoma to prevent a vote on a new redistricting plan. And spokesman Ari Fleischer announces that President Bush has officially filed papers for re-election. Jack Beatty, terror back in the news this week with a big boom.
A big boom, and maybe back even as a political issue with Senator Graham's charge. He's not just your ordinary senator. As we remember, he was the co-chair of the Select Committee on Intelligence that looked into September 11th. And he seems to be coupling the charge that the administration has been distracted by Iraq and has fallen behind in the war on terror with the request that the administration release the report that his committee prepared about the September 11th disaster. Now, if the administration sits on that report for too long, he'll perhaps even begin leaking some of it himself, and maybe we'll find out some things in that report the administration doesn't want us to know.
But what do you think, Jack? Is there room here to put a wedge between administration demonstrations of American military might and effective terror fighting, or do they look like one and the same to much of the public?
I really don't know about that. I mean, perhaps they do. It was shocking to me how many, the polls showed how many people believed that Saddam Hussein was responsible for September 11th, something that even the Bush administration didn't claim. But the issue of effectiveness does come to the fore here. And, the administration pushes things every which way. They were pushing all kinds of pressure on Syria. And, of course, we know that Syria last year was extremely helpful in the war on terror, especially with regard to some of those terrorists apprehended in Hamburg. And now Syria has again done something in heading off an attempt to blow up the U.S. embassy in Beirut, according to reports. So while Syria is helping us in the war on terror, we're putting pressure on the Syrians, or at least Rumsfeld was, even talking about invading them.
At the same time, though, everybody watching these bodies come up out of the ground in Iraq this week with sorrow and relief that regime is gone.
It has to be said, even by opponents of the war, that this was a horrifying regime and that his departure is nothing but to the good. On the other hand, the New Republic is reporting, as we mentioned several weeks ago, that militia are now arming across Iraq, getting ready for a civil war.
Let's hope not. On the home front, tax cuts that President Bush has pushed hard for getting closer.
Yes, they are. And the Senate last night passed a $350 billion version of what the president wanted. The House, $550 billion. It'll probably be somewhere in between when we get the final bill. And, of course, many of these tax cuts are to sunset after 2007. That, of course, is a dodge. They won't sunset because no politician votes to abolish taxes.
No politician votes to abolish tax cuts, I guess.
Tax cuts, I beg your pardon. Yes, to raise taxes. So, I want to give another hamburger to my kid today because he's going to live in the most indebted generation that ever assume maturity in American history. These kids are going to have to really work hard to pay off all the debt and deficit we're leaving on them.
But if George Bush's frontline statement is correct, this will stimulate an economy that will put them in a better position to pay taxes and pay back debt.
Well, I tend to agree with the 400 economists and 20-odd Nobel Prize winners who signed a letter to the contrary, doubting that would happen. And even in the president's claim of creating 1.4 million jobs, that would cost something like, around $100,000 a job.
Yeah, I know a lot of people would sign up for a job.
I'd go for that in a minute.
Jack, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Todd.
On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, Tamar Morad, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Scope, with help from Chris O'Connor and Sabi Mir. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.